83. If you need to go, go now. None of them moved, Zig, Roddy, or Elijah, all three staying in the car, staring straight ahead at the Sunoco Minimart, where 4 20-something guys walked out the front door. That's a lot of backwards hats, Zig said. Jersey, Elijah offered. Zig nodded, turning back to his phone, where he was texting with Wags. You free? She had asked, with extra question marks. Zig knew what that meant. You found something, didn't you? Zig texted. Tell me. You still with Shaggy and Scooby? Tell me what you found, Zig texted. Voicemail from tech guy Gary was about to call him back. Thought you might want to join. Zig's eyes slid sideways toward Elijah, who was on his own phone, Facebook scrolling by the looks of it. Can't. Let me know what he says, Zig texted back. Wags gave it a little thumbs up. 3 gray dots appeared on screen. Then finally, an Enola sighting. Zig checked the rearview, still convinced she couldn't be far. Actually, I do have to go. To the bathroom, Roddy added, opening the car door and sliding out. He took a few steps toward the mini-mart, then doubled back and knocked on Zig's window. Everything okay? Zig asked, tucking his phone in his pocket. They have ice cream sandwiches, Roddy said, pointing to a sign in the window showing a Fat Boy ice cream sandwich propped up on a chipwich. Buy one, get one free, he explained. I can't resist an ice cream sandwich. Want me to grab one for you? I'm good, Zig said. Mr. Elijah? I'm fine, too, Elijah added from the passenger seat. I'll probably get an extra anyway, you know. Buy one, get one, Roddy said, heading toward the mini-mart. For a moment, Zig and Elijah sat there, watching through the windshield as the crowd of 20-somethings took a look at Roddy's police uniform and parted around him. Roddy disappeared inside without acknowledging any of them. His belt doesn't quite go through all the loops, does it? Elijah asked. I like to think he's got the parachute, but he might be missing the ripcord. Elijah started to laugh, but his face was serious. You sure you trust him? Who? Roddy? Zig paused. It's complicated. It shouldn't be. I get that he's worried about his sister. But where we're going? This security guard Axel. If he's even there. If he knows something about the 22 million. You really think we should put Roddy in the center of that? There was a click from the gas pump. The tank was filled. Then a loud knock at the window. Zig jumped at the sound of the attendant, a curly-haired kid wearing an Elliot in the Morning button on his surprisingly clean Sunoco shirt, and yet another backward cap knocking on the window. 3727, curly hair said. Zig gave him 2 20s, pantomiming to keep the change. At the bar, when you said you spoke to Nola, the way he jumped at you, exploding instantly, Elijah added, when someone's got a fuse that short, you don't sit them next to the dynamite. I'm not saying he's not weird. Weird is fine. We're all weird, brother. Back in the day, his sister was weird, too. But Roddy and his little fuse? Let me say it like this. When we're trying to talk our way inside Grandma's pantry, you sure he won't detonate? It made Zig think back to Roddy gripping his shoulder, that empty look in Roddy's eyes when a switch seemed to flip, or when the Reds attacked and Roddy savagely pummeled Seabass's face over and over and over. Was that normal behavior? Of course not. Though the attack on Seabass probably saved Zig's life. That had to count for something, right? Zig took a breath, eyeing Roddy in the mini-mart heading for the freezer. From day one, Roddy had been working this case as hard as anyone. Their interests were aligned, and if Zig was being honest, without Roddy, they might have never gotten this far, much less found Elijah. In the end, though, Zig kept coming back to what he always came back to. Nola. to see her at the funeral home, hiding in the bathroom, scrambling to open the window, practically smashing through the glass to get away from her brother. She was running from him, and Nolan never ran from anyone. "You don't know who he is at his core," Nola had warned. It was an overdramatic thing to say, but the question remained. Who did Zig believe? Inside the mini-mart, Roddy opened the freezer case, letting the cool air waft over him, his arms wide, like he'd just conquered Everest. "Elijah, how much farther did you say Grandma's pantry was?"
20 minutes, tops," Elijah replied. "If it makes you feel better, we can call him an Uber or a—"
Zig pulled out his phone to send Wags a text. Instead, he saw a text from his wife.
"Call me. I'm on M's case," Charmaine wrote, using the single initial they always used for their daughter. It'd have to wait.
Swiping back to Wags's question, "Any Nola sighting?" Zig sent a final text. "She's gotta be close." He then started the car and put it in drive. Roddy was still in the mini-mart, grabbing his ice cream sandwiches.
"It's the right call," Elijah said as they pulled out of the gas station.
Picking up speed and veering toward the turnpike, Zig kept glancing in the rearview, the mini-mart shrinking behind them, a pinprick in the darkness. He was already second-guessing himself. But he didn't slow down.
84. 6 minutes ago.
"They slowing down?" Reagan asked, glancing over at the handheld GPS that Seabass was clutching in the passenger seat. A half hour ago, on screen, a small red triangle weaved down Shoemaker Boulevard, leaving Elijah's craft beer bar and heading for the turnpike. Zig and Roddy were on the move, but now, finally, they were pumping the brakes, pulling into a rest stop by the looks of it.
"Gas brake," Reagan realized.
Seabass agreed, studying the map. They weren't far. Time to close the gap. Tugging the steering wheel and veering into the turnpike's right lane, Reagan punched the gas, blowing past a stubborn Mazda with a bumper sticker that read, "I was an honor student. I don't know what happened." They both read the sticker. They both glanced at each other. Seabass's eyes curled into a grin, the baseball-sized gauze shifting on his cheek.
"Sebby, don't laugh at dumb jokes like that. If you do, we get more of—"
A phone buzzed, both of them now eyeing the cheap silver flip phone vibrating in the cup holder. Caller ID showed a number they'd never seen before, but they knew who it was. The first time he called, they ignored it. Second time, too. This was the third, all within a few minutes. Seabass shot her a look.
Maybe he knows where they're headed.
The phone rang again. Reagan rolled her eyes. "Ellis Jewelers," she answered.
"I call you 3 times and you don't pick up," Mr. Vess exploded. "Are you forgetting who you work for?"
Reagan hung up, tossing the phone back in the cup holder.
"Is that really helpful?"
Seabass said with a head shake. "Vrrt." The phone buzzed again. She let it ring once more, just to teach Vess a lesson. "Have you learned to speak like an adult?" she finally answered, putting him on speaker.
"Do not pick a fight with me," Vess warned. "This is for your benefit. You're about to have a problem."
"Not until you tell me about this number. Where are you calling from?"
"Elberton General."
"The hospital?
Why would you—" "Because I got shot in the fucking leg. And my toe. I lost my—" "She shot off my toe."
"Slow down. Who's she?"
"You think she left a business card? Skinny bitch. Silver and black hair. Eyes deader than yours, Reagan. The way she was talking, she said you know her brother. Some cop. Roddy something."
"Roddy LaPointe," Reagan said, now curious as Seabass turned her way. "What did she say about him?"
"I'm in a hospital gown with my ass hanging out. I don't care about him or the mortician or every other damn rando who can't seem to stay away from this giant shitfest Zion sucked us into. The only thing I give 2 craps about right now is her. From here on in, she's the mission. There must be consequences."
Vess was still ranting as Reagan tossed a look toward the passenger seat. The moment Seabass was shot in the face, they were done with the job, done taking orders, done protecting Vess's business, and certainly done with his current revenge fantasy. From here on in, their only priority was Roddy. If it helps. You can track her, Vess added. She has my... She took my phone and iPad. You mean the phone you've been calling us on? Reagan challenged. Seabass cocked an eyebrow. Earlier, they'd tossed Zion's phone to keep anyone from following. Even if she was on their trail, it wouldn't be hard to lose her again. Snatching the flip phone, Seabass opened the window to toss it outside. Don't! Reagan warned, grabbing his arm. She took back the phone as a whirlwind of air twisted through the car. Turning back to Vess, she added, When did she leave your office? 1/2 hour ago, tops. Reagan nodded, doing the math. They'd still reach Zig and Roddy first. You're not even listening, are you? Vess asked. For 30 years I've been dealing with vengeful pricks. This girl, though, she's different. You can see it in her eyes. She's got broken parts inside. She sounds unbearable, Reagan said as Seabass nodded. Neither of them was worried. Like her dad taught, if you want to hit the cover off a curveball, you just have to know when it's coming. Reagan glanced down at the GPS. 14 minutes to destination. Plenty of time to be ready. 85. Now. Zig was confused, and he never liked that. A few miles back, when he first spotted one of the big green highway signs with a little airplane graphic at the bottom, he didn't think much of it. On the New Jersey Turnpike, everything connects with the airport sooner or later. Even when Elijah told him, next exit, and Zig pulled off at 13A, labeled Elizabeth, along with a bigger airplane graphic, Zig focused on the former, assuming this was just the first step to a smaller, less trafficked area better able to hide a secret government facility. God knows, between the ports, freight yards, and all the surrounding warehouses and refineries, Newark was full of nondescript areas to choose from. Hell, it was big enough to hold the first U.S. IKEA. Yet, as the exit ramp looped them into a wider stretch with multiple lanes, "Stay in the middle," Elijah said, pointing to the lane labeled Airport Traffic Only. Zig glanced around, searching the distance. The road narrowed and twisted, then narrowed even more, eventually dead-ending at a single-lane service road. In front of them, turnpike shrubbery gave way to a chain-link fence and signs for terminals A, B, C, home of Newark International Airport. "Are we flying somewhere?" Zig asked. Elijah flashed a grin. Today, there are 11 undisclosed strategic national stockpiles, 11 grandma's pantry warehouses carefully hidden across the country. In choosing locations, all 11 were logistically situated to maximize their ability to send supplies to the closest neighboring states. Naturally, secrecy was also key. A stockpile in the northwest was located on a horse breeding ranch, in a long aluminum-sided building designed to look like a slaughterhouse in satellite photos. The one in the Midwest was hidden in an old jelly bean factory. But all 11 had one thing in common. They were all near an airport, although only one was located in one. On Zig's left, a United 737 buzzed low in the night sky, its engines roaring as it came in for a landing. "Don't look so shocked," Elijah teased. "It's why people love big cities. See, you can hide in plain sight." "Wait. So, Grandma's pantry," Zig said, still glancing around. "You're telling me it's..." "You were expecting a neon sign?" "Make a left," Elijah said, pointing with his chin. "We're almost there." 86. Keenly, Pennsylvania. 14 years ago. This was Nola when she was 14. Acne Steve had brought cigars to poker night. Nola didn't mind the stench. It was actually better than what Royal's friends usually smelled like. But when they smoked, they drank more, which meant they made more of a mess, which meant, for Nola, there was more to clean.
"Come on, dickface, use an ashtray," Royal shouted at repeating Francis, who smoked cloves just to be a pain. "Nola, on it," she said with a glance, already rushing to the kitchen to grab an extra ashtray.
Royal started to say something else.
"And pretzels, I saw," Nola added, eyeing the empty pretzel bowl on the foldable side table.
Across the room, Steve's son Trey looked up from his newest device. A T-Mobile Sidekick, a high-tech phone with its own QWERTY keyboard, then glanced back down, going back to whomever he was texting.
"Possible to get some more ice, please?" said Chubby Digger from the gas station, who'd started wearing a Bluetooth earpiece to remind everyone he was now Assistant Manager Digger from Tire Kingdom.
Nola knew it made him look like a tool, but Digger was the only one who ever said please.
"And a blowjob. Can you get us one of those, hun?" Hartley Spencer teased, his narrow, penny-colored eyes locked on Nola's ass.
"Hartley, don't be a turd," Digger scolded. Nola ignored the joke. She'd heard worse, though she did take the long way around so Hartley wouldn't have a chance to sniff her. As she passed Trey on the couch, the sulky 10th grader looked up, shaking his head at the adults. It was a moment of solidarity, though Nola didn't know how to read it. She just liked his light brown eyes, the color of iced tea, and was mesmerized by the all-knowing maturity and general hostility that he was endlessly directing at his own dad. Nola understood that better than anyone. As a new hand was dealt, Royal and his friends debated their usual topics, like whether the girl at the Vin's Groceries deli counter had real tits or falsies, which quickly devolved into tearing Acne Steve apart for using the word falsies in front of his son. In the kitchen, as Nola refilled the pretzel bowl, even she laughed at that. In truth, she liked these nights. Life was better, or at least easier when there were friends to keep Royal busy. She even found herself rooting for a few of them, like repeating Francis. And for Digger, who would probably do better if he ever figured out that he would clench his teeth behind his lips and start counting everyone's chips every time he bluffed.
"Okay, donkeys, out of pity, I'll keep this small. 1, 2,
Royal counted, tossing 2 orange chips, $100 into the pot.
"I'm gonna push. I need to get my kid home," Acne Steve said, raising with 4 chips, everyone knowing that whenever he sounded like he was in a rush to leave, that meant he had a fantastic hand. Not as good as Hartley's, though.
"Check," Hartley said, trying to play it cool. In the kitchen, Nola had pulled an ice tray from the freezer, twisting it back and forth, then grabbing a nearby knife to pry out the stubborn cubes.
"Come on," she said, wiggling the knife, working the far side of the tray and putting her weight into it, the knife now facing her own belly.
In the living room, Royal and his friends were getting louder. She was too preoccupied to hear it. To keep suspicion low, Royal only had her spy when his cards were good. This was one of those hands, though neither of them knew it at the time. Gripping the knife with both hands, Nola wedged it toward herself, working it back and forth, the plastic tray sounding like it was about to crack. She pushed harder, her knuckles going red until, thwip! Just like that, the final cube popped out, sliding across the counter. Nola scooped it up, tossed it in a bowl, and grabbed it along with the pretzels and the ashtray.
"And I'll repop you to 300, Acne Steve said, tossing his chips into what had quickly become the biggest pot of the night.
"Call," Royal said, betting the same and eyeing Nola as she re-entered the living room. She knew that look. Time to go to work.
"I'll raise to whatever Royal's got left," Hartley teased as Nola placed the pretzels on the side table.
She was smart, taking her time before approaching the main table with the ice and ashtray.
"To be honest, I wish you had some more, since I love robbing you blind."
"How much more you want to raise too, Norm?" Royal challenged, using the name his favorite TV private eye used when he wanted to give someone a verbal shove.
More than you got in that piss pot, Hartley shot back as Nola slowly rounded the table. I'm out, Acne Steve said, tossing his cards, knowing the result when it got this personal. Me too. Fold, Digger said, the blue light blinking on his headset. Pick a number. Pick whatever you want, Royal said, reaching for his watch. I'll put my damn Piaget in if I have to. You think we don't know that watch is fake? Come on, Norm, Hartley shot back. Steve tried to sell us the exact same piece of garbage. You want to make shit interesting. Why don't you bet? I don't know. Hartley's eyes narrowed into thin slits as he flashed his own devil's smile. Her, he said, eyeing Nola. How about betting her? You're a skeeve, Royal said. I'm not talking sexual. Just, you know, like you got here. Housekeeper stuff. A night of housekeeper stuff. An afternoon, that's it. Nola froze mid-step, an ashtray in one hand, a glass of ice in the other. Leave her alone, a voice called from the sofa. They all turned toward Trey, the 10th grader, who had finally looked up from texting. What did you say? Trey's dad challenged. Steve-o? Tell your boy to watch his mouth, Hartley warned. Get your ass in the car! Go! Trey's dad bellowed, using a tone Nola had never heard him use before. No! With venom in his eyes, Trey stormed toward the door, stealing a beer from the side table as he left. At the moment, though, there were bigger issues to deal with. I ain't joking, Hartley said, everyone turning back to the poker table. I need a good housekeeper. Just for an afternoon. Nola stood there, the room so silent she could hear the ice popping in the glass. Come on, Royal. You're always talking that she's such a pain in the ass. Put your money where your fat mouth is. How good you feeling about those cards? 87. Today. Newark Airport was not a quiet place. Last year, as the 12th busiest airport in the country, it served over 46 million passengers. To pull it off requires pictorial and international signs, TSA officers who speak 24 different languages, and outdoor maps labeled with oversized arrows to make sure people won't get lost going from long-term parking to the main terminals. Still, there's one street at Newark Airport that's always been a bit harder to find. Conrad Road. Put it into Google Maps. Where it crosses Brewster Road, the service road surrounding the airport, the street view simply stops. Most people assume it's a glitch, or that it's because of what's on the corner in Building 15, the small but elegant private jet terminal known as Signature, which serves gourmet tea in a well-appointed lounge as you wait for your private charter. Certainly, the Signature clientele prefer the anonymity. Still others, the Newark employees who have been here for decades, assume it's due to what's at the end of the block, the Art Deco historic site known as Building 1. Built in 1935, with a semicircular canopy that resembles a South Beach hotel, Building 1 was Newark's original terminal, hosting aviation legends like Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh. After World War II, as the airport expanded, Building 1 became too small. But to preserve its history, the entire concrete structure was cut into thirds and moved here, to Conrad Road, where it became the headquarters for the airport's own law enforcement, the Port Authority Police Department. When 9/11 hit, it was the perfect excuse to get Conrad Road blurred on Google Maps. But that wasn't the real reason. Nearly every day, some random tourist accidentally turns onto Conrad Road. Some are smart enough to ask directions in the private jet terminal on their left. Others make it all the way to the end of the block, to the police station. Both are perfect distractions. People are so busy staring at the private planes or the crush of parked cop cars, they don't look twice at what's across the street. A fenced-in parking lot with a prefab guard booth like you'd find at a gated community. It was the same tonight. The shed looked old, by design, though the windows were bulletproof. Inside was a guard, a fit, middle-aged man with heavy-lidded eyes, chewing nicotine gum like it was his final meal. On late shifts like this, he knew to keep the lights in the booth off. Indeed, since his bosses jammed all cell signals for security and location purposes, his silhouette was lit only by the faint glow of his laptop, which he was using to watch a YouTube video counting down the best TV theme songs. He was singing along with the theme to Different Strokes when a set of bright headlights appeared up the block. "What you talking about, Willis?" he muttered, thinking of his mom, who used to hate the show because back in Providence, Rhode Island, Reverend Williams once incorrectly said there was an episode where they cussed, using the B word, as she used to call it. Mama hated the B word, telling her son that if you want to be a man, you speak like a gentleman. She wasn't wrong, he thought, eyeing the car up the block. It was slowing down, like every other lost tourist. Typically, most cars headed for the police station across the street, but when the lights turned his way and the car pulled toward his booth, he didn't think much of it, especially these days. Some people won't trust cops. "Let me guess," the guard announced, opening the drive-through window and squinting toward the headlights. "You can't find the main terminal."
"Actually, Axel, the only thing we're looking for is you."
The guard, Axel Padilla, took a half step back, not even hearing the Miami Vice theme playing from his laptop.
"Son of a bee."
Zig smiled from the driver's seat. Next to him, Elijah leaned closer for a better view.
"Come on, Axel. This is your moment," Elijah offered, his caterpillar eyebrows knitting together. "Here's the part where you're supposed to say, 'Welcome to Grandma's Pantry.'"
88. Newark Airport. "You're sure?" Seabass nodded. "Think they got on a flight?" Reagan asked. Seabass shook his head, pointing to the little red triangle on their GPS, then scrolling sideways on the map. "A police station? Why would they park by a police station?"
"That's the question," Seabass said with a glance.
Flashing his plastic mouth guard, he was trying to look animated, but really just looked paler than ever. The gauze on his cheek was clean, the bleeding stopped. But the way he was clenching his jaw, the white in his eyes, now yellow, he could lie to most people, but not to her.
"Sebi, I'm dropping you off," she said, tugging the steering wheel toward the next exit.
"Don't," he pleaded, grabbing the wheel, the car swerving back into its lane.
"I'm fine."
"You look like death."
"We do this together,"
he insisted, pointing to her, then back to himself. That was their rule for years now. He tightened his glance.
"That's how it's always done. Together."
She nodded, knowing he was right, hoping he was right, adrenaline kicking in as her anger at Zig, at Roddy, and especially at herself, swallowed her in a rage.
"You sure you're okay?" she asked, glancing over.
Seabass forced a grin, quickly sitting up straight. He couldn't break his sweat. Coppery saliva slid down his throat. He was swallowing blood, and it was getting worse. On his left, he glanced over at Reagan, who was clenching the steering wheel, staring straight ahead with that inferno in her eyes. There was nothing more attractive than someone who knows what they want. How could he deny her that?
"I'm fine," he told her, smiling excitedly with his eyes.
"You sure?" She reached out, putting a hand on his shoulder to physically feel if he was telling the truth.
"Reagan, I'm fine. I swear."
She nodded like she believed it. She had to believe it.
"Just 5 minutes," she said,
hitting the gas and steering toward the exit for Newark Airport.
"That's all it'll take."
As the curve of the exit ramp sent him leaning against the car door, Seabass gave her a thumbs up. 5 minutes and they'd be done. Simple as that. 89. Zig was trying to ignore the light drizzle, trying to keep up with Elijah and the guard in the blue windbreaker, Axel, as they darted through the empty parking lot. Axel tried making an excuse about leaving his post, but he didn't have a choice. Along the side of the building was a parked trailer. There was a refrigeration unit on top. They had trailers like these back at Dover. Overflow freezers for when the bodies piled up. Here, they kept trailers like this to ship across the country, which is what they did when COVID first hit. Yet as Zig got closer, he caught a glimpse of a pair of eyes peeking out from below the trailer, reflecting through the darkness like tiny milky mirrors. Initially, he thought it was a cat, but the snout, the pointy nose, plus that thick rope of a tail? A possum, fat and crouched like a ball, was nibbling furiously at something. To Zig, who would never admit to being superstitious, just the sight of it felt like a bad omen, though the science side of his brain knew that was absurd. A hot drop of summer rain hit Zig at the center of his forehead, like a bullseye. He wiped it away almost frantically. "You okay?" Axel called back, still chomping on his nicotine gum. "Just get us inside," Zig insisted, which really was all Axel was trying to do. Picking up speed and leaving the mobile mortuary behind, they followed the curve of the lot toward the front of a gray concrete warehouse that had all the charm of a prison. Similar buildings were scattered all across the airport perimeter, with mundane names like M&H International, Swiss Haven USA, and Longport Logistics, featureless warehouses dedicated to shipping, exporting, and everything else that goes with the infrastructure of an airport. On a brown awning, the words K&W Importers were so faded, you could barely make them out from the street. Which was the point. "Marlin, I got two," Axel said into his walkie-talkie. Zig thought about getting Wags on the line. He pulled out his phone. No signal. Elijah had warned him as much. As they approached the doorway, Zig spotted two separate black dome security cameras, both with solid steel mounting plates and collars. Same as Dover, military level. But what he noticed most of all was how quiet Elijah suddenly was. "You see something?" Zig whispered. Elijah shook his head, glancing at the dents in the old door, the rips in the old awning, the cracks in the building, all of it. So many memories. Last time Elijah was here, on that night 5 years ago, he lost the life he'd had, or at least the life he'd planned for himself. If Zig understood anything, he understood that. "If you're armed, there are gun lockers inside," Axel added. There was a low buzz, then a magnetic click as the door popped open. "I smell rain. It raining out there," the receptionist Marlin called out in a Bronx bellow. Sitting at an L-shaped desk, he was older than Axel, with sandy blonde hair, hands that moved like hummingbirds, and a lopsided grin. Heart or no heart? Zig didn't know why, but he liked him instantly. "It's a good evening for a good evening," Marlin added as the three of them entered. "This is... wow, it's all the same. You didn't even change the old posters," Elijah said, glancing around like some middle-aged alumnus walking into his old dorm. On the walls were faded oversized photos of the Gulf War parade in New York City, as well as one of President Biden placing the Medal of Honor around a soldier's neck. On their right, a coffee table held a neat pile of Army Times newspapers. In the corner were two sets of gray metal lockers with at least 50 safe deposit-sized doors, one set marked phones, the other guns.
"Marlin, thanks for buzzing us in," Axel said, not slowing down but adding a wave as he passed the desk. He was headed for the closed metal door dead ahead and the metal detector protecting it, the true entrance to Grandma's pantry.
"I already cleared them both."
"On the V-log?" Marlin asked, sounding confused, turning to the visitor's log on his computer. His hummingbird hands danced across the keyboard.
"I don't see anyone listed in..."
There was a click. Zig turned at the sound. It was already too late. Reaching into his jacket, Elijah had pulled out a gun, a bright nickel-plated and polished HK-P7. He racked the slide and chambered around.
"I'm sorry, son, but this is on you," Elijah said, aiming the pistol at Marlin's face.
Marlin's head was still down, his eyes on the computer screen. He never saw it coming.
"Elijah, no!" Axel shouted.
"Don't!" Zig added. There was a thunderclap. Bits of blood and bone hit the wall, causing a spiderweb crack in the framed photo from the Gulf War parade. The way Marlin's head was bent, The bullet hit a soft spot that fractured the top of his skull in a messy crater. Zig was still yelling as Marlin's head teetered and wobbled, then slowly sagged forward, momentum taking over, his forehead pounding the keyboard with a sickening thud.
"What are you? Are you insane?" Axel exploded.
Elijah barely reacted, his gun still raised, fingers still on the trigger.
"He was about to buzz us in," Axel added.
"He was looking us up," Elijah said, calm as could be.
"So what if he has kids, a daughter starting college, and now he...
Axel clenched both fists.
"You said no one would get hurt."
"No," Elijah said, rolling his eyes. "That doesn't sound like me at all." In one quick movement, Elijah turned his gun toward Axel and pulled the trigger. Another thunderclap. A black burn mark appeared in Axel's forehead just above his left eyebrow. This hit was clean, instantly sending Axel backward, like a marionette with cut strings crashing to the carpet. A decade ago, Navy psychologists studied how humans react when faced with imminent death. According to action movies, everyone in the crowd runs and screams. In reality, however, your most likely reaction is simply doing nothing. Faced with fear, we freeze. Zig reached for his knife. Elijah was faster, aiming his gun. "Mr. Zigarowski, whatever you've got in your pocket, I suggest you leave it there." Zig stopped, his fingertips still at his pocket. "So that story you told us back at the bar, about the reason OJ fired you. He suspected you, but couldn't prove it."
"If it makes you feel better,
he's a shitbag and he suspected me.
Which is more than I can say for you."
Raising his gun to Zig's face, Elijah slid his finger around the trigger. "Don't look so wounded, Mr. Zigarowski. This was the twist you should have seen coming." "I actually did, asshole." Click. Elijah was still facing the welcome desk, so focused on Zig, he didn't hear the door to the parking lot open behind him, and he certainly didn't feel the barrel of the gun until it was pressing into the back of his own head. "You really think he'd leave me at a janky rest stop?" Roddy asked a bit too loudly in Elijah's ear. "Oh, and by the by, that fancy beer in your bar sucked." "Come on, Elijah. Don't look so wounded," Zig added. "This was the twist you should have seen coming."
90. Houston, Texas. 14 years ago. This was Roddy when he was 14. It was just a matter of the paperwork.
"Sit," the police officer said, shoving teenage Roddy in handcuffs and an M&M buzz cut toward the metal chair. Roddy knew he was in trouble the moment he entered the room. Two-way mirror, desk bolted to the floor. This wasn't the juvenile area. This was an adult interrogation room.
"Bad day for you, dumbass," said Officer Barry Baltamacchia,
though everyone in the station called him Bull for always breathing so hard through his nose. He was 43, but like so many overweight cops, looked at least a decade older. Bull was right, though. It was a bad day. 2 hours ago, Roddy had been prowling the Nordstrom parking lot, using a bolt cutter and screwdriver to clip hood ornaments from any Mercedes or Jaguars unlucky enough to be parked nearby. Vegas Larry at the body shop offered $75 apiece for them. Roddy already had two Mercedes ornaments in his pocket. As he started working on a third, a gray S-Class that needed a wash, he got spotted.
"Hey," shouted a 40-something black anesthesiologist who was ROTC in college and had seen a few too many Spider-Man movies. Deciding he had great responsibility, the man headed toward Roddy.
"What are you doing?"
"Suck yourself," Roddy shot back. That was his first mistake, picking the fight. His second was thinking he had a chance. Roddy was 14. The anesthesiologist had at least 50 pounds on him. As the man rushed forward, Roddy instinctively sliced the screwdriver through the air, in self-defense, really, slashing a deep scratch across the man's forearm. That was his final mistake. 6 seconds later, Roddy was face down on the ground, screaming in pain, his shoulder dislocated, his arm pinned behind his back.
When Officer Bull arrived on scene, his first reaction was laughter.
"You don't even realize what you did, do you, dumbass?" Bull asked as Roddy took a seat in the interrogation room.
Roddy didn't say a word, even as Bull placed an evidence bag with the screwdriver on the table in front of him.
"Moron, know what happens when you use a weapon?"
"That ain't a weapon. You slashed his arm."
"It's a weapon, which means you just kicked this up from robbery to felony assault. Happy birthday, fool. No more juvie for you. Now you're all my—"
"Bull, your wife's on line 3. Again, announced a female voice through Bull's walkie-talkie. Bull didn't move.
"She sounds upset," the female voice added.
With a huff of air through his nose, Bull undid Roddy's handcuffs and recuffed them to the thick metal bar bolted to the table.
"Don't move," he warned, stuffing the screwdriver in his pocket and heading to the door. What he didn't say was that his wife was at a doctor's appointment this morning.
They'd found a lump.
"Can you at least get me a snack?"
"I heard you give snacks," Roddy called back as the officer reached the threshold.
Bull never made it. Crumpling sideways, he hit the floor with an awkward thud. At first, Roddy thought it was a joke, a pratfall, or that he'd tripped on the plastic wastebasket. But as Roddy craned his neck,
"Officer, you okay?"
Bull was curled on his side, wheezing, his body convulsing, his eyes rolled back in his head. Later, they'd say his blood sugar dropped, causing a diabetic seizure. As with any emergency, the key was how quickly they could react.
"Officer?"
A small puddle of blood expanded from Bull's forehead. He'd hit his head when he fell. Roddy's mouth went dry. He tried standing up, but his handcuffs were chained to the table. He couldn't get up, much less get near him. Roddy glanced around. He could still yell for help, get someone to come. Then a new thought hit Roddy. Peeking out of Bull's pocket, there it was, the plastic bag, the screwdriver. If Bull died here, if he didn't get help, no one would know what happened. All Roddy had to do was keep his mouth shut. On the floor, the convulsing and wheezing stopped, replaced by a stillness that Roddy had never seen before. Bull's head jerked slightly. He was foaming at the mouth, frothy saliva making the puddle of blood pink. "Just stay quiet," Roddy told himself. "It's your chance for a new start." Bull wasn't moving. At all. Roddy stayed locked on the bright yellow handle of the screwdriver. The room was so quiet, he could hear the crick of his own neck, little bones shifting. "Just keep your damn mouth shut.
Help! Someone! He needs help!"
Roddy shouted, leaping to his feet. When no one answered, he banged the table, screaming louder.
"Please! Someone help! This dude's dying!"
2 hours later, Roddy sat there all alone in the office of someone named Detective Conaway. He was munching on a bag of Funyuns from the vending machine, waiting in a wooden chair that looked like it escaped from a 1960s schoolhouse.
"Funyuns? That's the best they could do," a raspy voice called out.
Roddy didn't look up as Officer Bull hobbled into the office, plopping into the seat next to him. Once the EMTs had given him some apple juice, his blood sugar stabilized, which is really all they can do, though he was still moving with the grace of a landbound walrus.
"They should at least give you the extra quarter for Cool Ranch Doritos," Officer Bull added.
Roddy stayed quiet, rubbing Funyun dust from his fingertips.
"You know they're calling you a hero," Bull said.
Roddy rolled his eyes. Even he thought it was absurd.
"Want to know what I think?" Bull asked.
Before Roddy could answer, Bull pulled out the plastic bag with the screwdriver and slapped it against the desk. Roddy stared, looking confused.
"What? You're letting me go? What, are you insane?
Of course not. You vandalized multiple cars, stole hood ornaments, and slashed a doctor's forearm. He wants his pound of flesh for that.
But since my wife got a good report, and I'm in a really grateful mood right now, instead of felony assault, I'm going to ask for reduced charges.
I'll also be testifying on your behalf in the juvenile court, Bull explained. The judge will probably have you do community service, but here's the catch. Bull paused for a solid 10 seconds. That community service, a full year of it, is going to be done right here, in police headquarters. Roddy's eyebrows knit together. I don't get it. This a punishment, or what you did today? That was a good thing, Bull explained. And yeah, with the screwdriver, you also did a bad thing. But no one's all one thing. That's how it is for all of us. Like my favorite detective taught me, it's not what you've done. It's what you do next that defines you. Does that make sense? Not really. You're not a bad kid, Roddy. You hear me? You're not a bad kid. Today, when the crap hit the fan, you picked the right side. You gotta keep picking the good one. Roddy shook his head, still confused. Why are you doing this? Bull thought about it. You'll see. He was right. When Roddy's community service was done, they brought him on as an intern, where he worked until he got his GED. Eventually, when Roddy applied for the police academy, Bull wrote his recommendation. Roddy was on the path to being a ringleader, but now he's a real leader. He was right about that, too. 91. Today. There was a bug in her car. A tiny larder beetle, black with mustard spots, crawling diagonally up the windshield. Wags knew it on sight, from an incident a few years back when she learned larder beetles feast on dry pet food. Assuming it was outside, Wags hit the windshield wipers and the gas, hoping highway speeds and aerodynamics would clear it away. The wipers never touched it. The beetle was inside. Does every damn creature on the planet need something from me today? You need something too? She asked. Overhead, the car's hands-free speakerphone let out a throaty ring, Wags still waiting for the person to pick up on the other line. In the pause between rings, she rolled down the passenger window a few inches, as if the small gap would affect the level of suction. I'm trying to free you, Wags shouted at the beetle, wind whipping through the car. It still didn't budge. Wags? That you? You in a wind tunnel? A male voice announced, picking up. Yeah, let me just... With the push of a button, Wags closed the window, the beetle still in place. I called you twice. Where you been? Gary asked. It was a bad sign. For nearly a decade, Gary's conversations led with small talk, usually about whatever obscure BBC detective show he was suddenly obsessed with, before he explained your IT problem. If he was diving into business. You found who was in Mint's Black House account? Wags asked. Actually, by design, all Black House accounts are binary, with seeded hash and the highest entropy keys, meaning they can't board. Speak English, not instruction manual, Wags said, grabbing a notepad from the car's cup holder and leaning toward the passenger seat to swat the beetle from the windshield. Since she was still driving and holding the steering wheel, her arm wasn't long enough. Annoyed, she threw the pad at the beetle. Still didn't move. Wags, do you know how the NSA catches bad guys? If I say yes, can you get to your point? It's a philosophy. The NSA knows that if every crook has encryption and there's no way to get the keys, there's only one choice. You wait for the bad guys to make a mistake. So here, when you're dealing with secure operating systems or Starlink satellites, Gary, if you don't tell me who you found in Mint's account in the next 3 seconds, I'm going to drive straight to the office and throw away every damn action figure on your desk, including that homemade Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes Lego set. Gary went silent for a full 5 seconds. You can't tell anyone I told you this. Elementary, my dear Watson. Gary took a breath, and Wags could picture him tugging his shirt away from his sweaty belly. Wags. You need to understand, by design, Black House accounts don't come with an exploit, though they do come with instructions, and paramount among them is that it's designed to be used on mobile. You download the app, and that's what gives you security.
Exactly.
The app is a closed system. But if you run it on desktop, now Black House is going through a browser, which means open identifiers. Just give me the name, Gary.
Names. Plural.
There were two of them, though it doesn't give us actual IDs. We get IP addresses, which you can then use to...
You're speaking nerd again? Tell me the addresses.
One of them traced to a residence, owned by someone named Zion Lopez. Wags nodded. They already knew Zion was the one who'd pulled the trigger on Mint. The question was, who hired him? And why? According to Zig, it went back to the $22 million that was stolen 5 years ago from Grandma's pantry. So whoever was behind this, is that who was in Mint's Black House account? Did they think Mint stole the money and they were looking for it? Or was it the other way around? That Mint, and maybe Rashida, figured out who actually stole the money, and they were threatening to go public. Gary, I need the other person who was in Mint's account. Pull over. I'm texting you the address. Tell me if it looks familiar. On her phone, Wag swiped to texts. I don't see it.
Not until you pull over. For safety purposes, texting and driving isn't...
Gary, send the damn address! Her phone vibrated. The words popped on screen and her eyes went wide.
No. No, no, no.
Hanging up without a word, Wags quickly dialed Zig's number.
Come on, Ziggy, pick up.
No answer.
Of course.
At Grandma's pantry, they blocked all cells. Still, if Zig was already there, and if Nola was headed there too...
Wags hit the gas and the car took off. Up on the windshield, the Beetle hadn't moved.
Right in front of her, the entire time.
92. Nola didn't like being back here. Tugging the steering wheel hand over hand, she felt that familiar shift in her stomach, that same sense of dread from when she was little and would come home from school, grab a snack in the kitchen, and spot a newly emptied bottle of scotch in the trash. Even at 9 years old, it's not hard to know when trouble's coming. Tonight, as her car rounded the corner, Nola rode the brakes, taking it slow. There were no other cars around, no one in sight. At 9 p.m., the block was quiet, but it looked darker than she remembered. There, on her left, a bulb out in one of the streetlights. Mongol. Faber. She never got through it, never got to the names of the other pencils that her art teacher, Ms. Sable, had given her as a gift and that meant so much to her all those years ago. Just being here, being back here. This place was an echo, vibrating through her, vibrating through time, old memories tugging her down in their undertow. Years ago, during her first visit, Nola came here to do good, to set things right. But like any decision you look back on through the lens of time, what you marvel at most is how naive you were. Halfway up the block, Nola parked on the street. Better to approach by foot, so no one would see her coming. For a moment, she just sat there, wrists resting on the steering wheel, the undertow still tugging. She hated that feeling of old wounds throbbing like new wounds. But what she hated most of all was that old version of herself, the one who allowed her to get hurt in the first place. Kicking open the car door, she could see Mint on that first day. Could still hear his corny speech that everyone said he gave at the start of every investigation. Humans are born with two fears, falling and loud noises. Every other fear is learned. He was right, though that didn't make your fears any less real. Only way to do that was to tackle them head on. Speed walking up the block, Nola stuck to the shadows. The cars out front told her who was already there. And who wasn't? At just the sight of her destination, the undertow was overwhelming. It didn't slow her down. At the front entrance, she took a final glance over her shoulder and gave the doorknob a twist. To her surprise, there was a click. Unlocked. Never a good sign. If she were still in the army, this was when she was supposed to call the ops center for cover. Instead,
Nola reached into the back of her waistband and pulled her gun. Without a word, she elbowed open the front door and disappeared inside. 93. As Zig shoved a handcuffed Elijah into the warehouse, the first thing he noticed was the flag. He saw it the moment he stepped inside, hanging from the vaulted ceiling. The warehouse itself was wider than a Costco and BJ's side by side. Throughout its nearly 70 aisles, the words Grandma's Pantry weren't written anywhere. Outside, there was no sign for a strategic national stockpile. Yet as Zig stared up at the nearly football field-sized American flag, there was no mistaking the message. This place belonged to Uncle Sam. "Try there," Zig said, moving quickly to get out of sight and pointing to what looked like a conference room on their right. "It's gonna be locked," Elijah warned, his hands cuffed behind his back. Roddy squeezed the cuffs, steering Elijah between stacks of short pallets that clogged the front of the warehouse. 12-hour push packages, each loaded with 50 tons of antibiotics, antidotes, and medical supplies in case of a chemical or bioterror attack. On the left were industrial scales. On the right was a small parking lot of forklifts, all of it at the ready so that when the order was given, they'd race out onto Newark's runway and deliver salvation in 12 hours or less. "Mr. Zig?" "It's locked," Roddy said, trying the door. Elijah rolled his eyes. "Did I not just say that?" "Roddy, he's a liar. Ask him what the code is." "Are you both deaf?" Elijah asked. "There's no way in. These are senior staff offices." With a harder squeeze, Roddy pressed the cuff into Elijah's wrist. As Roddy learned during his first year on the job, handcuffs are their own art. A little pressure makes a tremendous impact. "Gah!" Elijah screamed, his body twisting in pain. "You do realize if Roddy breaks your wrists, someone will need to feed you for the next month?" Zig asked, taking a glance over his own shoulder. Back by the check-in desk, the guard, Axel, was face down in his own blood. The receptionist was slumped forward on his desk. Two more needless deaths, Zig thought. Fallen number 2549 and number 2550. "You, Sam, that's the passcode. They never change it," Elijah exclaimed as Roddy pressed Elijah's face into the door's keypad. "You, Sam, like Uncle Sam." Roddy quickly entered the passcode. There was a magnetic thunk. The door opened. Squeezing the cuffs even harder, Roddy steered Elijah toward the entrance. Behind them, Zig didn't follow. "You coming?" Roddy asked. Zig nodded, heading toward them and grabbing a final glance over his own shoulder. "You're looking for Nola, aren't you?" Roddy asked. "You think she's coming?" "Roddy, can you please just get Elijah inside so we can—" "You're not answering my question. If you know Nola's on her way, you think she'd tell me anything? That's not how she operates. But if I had to take a guess—" Click. The noise came from the main reception area, someone walking through the front door. As Zig started to turn, he had an actual smile on his face, a true dopey grin. That is, until he spotted the two people, a man and a woman, stepping across the threshold, joining them in the warehouse. Both redheads. "Mother trucker," Zig was about to say, though he never got the word out. Roddy was still in mid-turn, still gripping Elijah by the handcuffs. "Yeah, I see him," Reagan said, lifting her gun. In one quick motion, she aimed at Roddy and pulled the trigger. 94. Keenly, Pennsylvania. 14 years ago. This was Nola when she was 14. Royal didn't take Hartley's bait, more annoyed than anything else. Royal told him that this wasn't that absurd Demi Moore Robert Redford movie, and if he wanted to place a real bet with real money, he'd be happy to cover it. With pocket queens, Royal figured his full house would be an easy payday. Too bad Hartley had quads. Four of a kind. By the time the hand was done, Royal had lost $1,900. Hartley hiding his cards so well, Nola never got a good peek. For another hour and a half, Royal tried winning back his cash. Nola got him halfway there. Then it got late. The pretzel bowl was empty. That was the night. At nearly 1 a.m, as the guys were wrapping up, Nola ducked out into the backyard to fish beer cans from the trash. Royal had a guy who'd drive them to New York for a piece of the 5-cent deposit. He didn't like her doing it in the house, though. Thought it made them look cheap. Jesus, on a surfboard, is your dad cheap? Trey teased from a nearby lounge chair, the teenager's thin frame looking like a needle. On the arm of his chair was his sidekick, where a red notification light blinked in the dark. Nola grinned at the crack at Royal, breathing an actual sigh of relief. You doing this for you or him? Trey asked. At the foot of his chair were two empty beer cans. She thought he'd grabbed only one. He was faster than he looked. For him? Oh, shitty. Trey laughed as Nola continued to rummage through the trash. He quickly felt bad, his tone shifting. You should tell him to do it himself. Set him straight. Nola didn't answer. She knew he meant well, but she also knew what would happen if Royal thought she was complaining. Here, I can... Let me help, Trey added, hopping from his seat and heading toward her, the red light still blinking from the armrest. Your dad's gonna be looking for you, Nola warned, pointing over her own shoulder. He won't. He'll think I walked home, Trey said, reaching into the trash. The real fun'll start when I text my mom that he left me behind and messed up his court-appointed night with me. The way Trey spoke, using words like knives to stab at his parents, it wasn't something she'd soon forget. He's a dick like that, Trey added, standing on the opposite side of the trash as he pulled out a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon and two bottles of Stroh's, which forever would be the smell Nola associated with tonight. Across from him, Nola opened a plastic garbage bag to receive the recyclables. Trey threw the can inside, but as he went to hand over the bottles, he purposely missed the bag, letting one of the bottles plummet to the ground where it shattered across the concrete. What are you doing? Nola asked. Trey shrugged and shot Nola his own devil's grin, which lit her up in places she didn't realize lit up. Holding the second bottle with two fingers, like an arcade crane game, he cocked an eyebrow, about to let it go. Don't, she called out, reaching to grab it. She forgot how fast he was. He yanked the bottle up out of her reach. Her hand gripped his wrist. Too slow, he was about to say. He was fast for a drunk, but not nearly as fast as Nola. Before he could get the words out, she snatched the bottle from his hand. She held it up in victory. He playfully slapped it sideways, knocking it to the ground, where it shattered not far from the first one. Try it on purpose. It's better when you mean it, Trey said, reaching into the trash and handing her a new bottle. She wanted to tell him he was a moron. Instead, for reasons she couldn't explain, she let go of the bottle, letting it smash. Royal would definitely be pissed, but even she knew that's why it felt so good. Boy, am I clumsy tonight, Trey teased, dropping another bottle, then another Pabst Blue Ribbon can that hit with a hollow clink. I gotta say, I thought he was gonna bet you tonight, Trey added, stomping on the beer can to flatten it. Nola stayed silent. Finally, she offered, I appreciate you saying something to Hartley. You didn't have to. Eh? I was just protecting Hartley from you. She liked that. Seriously. I'm glad you're safe, Trey added, standing there, staring at her. The world needs pretty girls. And pretty boys, she shot back, blinking a few times, not sure where the words came from, wishing she could take them back, but not really. Not pretty boys. Cute boys, she corrected herself. However you call it. You know what I mean. She stared down at the trash. You should go. There's no more bottles to break. Trey grinned, the red light of his phone blinking behind him, a 1-second firework. You really think that's why I keep coming to my dad's lame poker nights? To play with some bottles? He asked. his eyes locking on Nola as he stepped toward her. Before she knew what was happening, he was kissing her. He smelled like werewolf and tasted like Pabst Blue Ribbon. But as he put his mouth on hers, my God, everything crumbled, and she was weightless, floating up, her feet leaving the ground. The instant he touched her, she was tempted to push him away. It was instinct. But she didn't. Why say no to something that felt this good? He pulled her close, and she could feel his stiffness pressing into her. Her hand reached down, another instinct to feel it. His fingers skated along the waistband of her jeans, setting her on fire. That was it. They were all over each other within seconds, she undoing the belt on his jeans, he undoing hers, the rush of hormones overwhelming. Still kissing, they stumbled together toward a nearby folding lounge chair. They were moving so fast, still off balance, they fell to the ground. She landed on her back, his full weight on top of her. Taking a breath, he pulled away, his face lit by the moon. She could see his bones moving under his skin, his iced tea eyes curved into a grin. "You sure?" "You don't have to," he asked with a glance. Nola froze. Years later, she'd replay this moment, knowing that this was the very last time Trey would ever speak to her. But on this night, as a teenage girl, all she kept thinking was how he tasted, and how good it felt, and how great it was to have someone look at you like that, with care and real affection, rather than anger and disgust. Royal would kill her just for kissing him. And really, in those picoseconds when rash decisions get made, it was that thought that first motivated her. She had no deep attachment to Trey. She barely knew him. Yet as he kissed her again, his one hand gripping the back of her head, the other sliding into her jeans, skating against the edge of her panties, she wasn't thinking of Royal at all. He was gone, for once, banished from existence. All that was left was this boy with the warmest eyes she'd ever seen, staring at her, staring through her, like she was revealed and he was mesmerized by what he saw. Nola didn't want much in life. But right now, she wanted this. "Do it," Nola said with a nod, as Trey lowered his jeans. She closed her eyes and tugged down her own jeans. Today, Nola would say the details were lost to her, but back then, even with her eyes shut, she couldn't avoid the beer on his breath. She thought she hated that smell, but right now, as he entered her, as weightlessness again lifted her out of her body, there was no sweeter smell or taste in the entire universe. She opened her eyes to make sure it was real and spotted Trey staring down at her, his reassuring gaze promising she was safe. At that, she closed her eyes, finally able to... "Boy, what the hell are you..." "Nola!" a voice interrupted. Trey jumped. No, he was yanked, flying sideways, off balance. "Get off her!" Royal exploded, tugging the back of Trey's shirt, choking him as Trey scrambled to pull up his pants. Nola did the same, still on the ground. "Get out of here!" she screamed. She wasn't talking to Royal. She was warning Trey. "She was all over me," Trey lied, climbing to his feet. Royal started to yell something, but instead buried a punch into Trey's stomach, then his face, blood bursting from Trey's nose. "That's my girl," Royal exploded. Trey was stumbling now, covering his face, just trying to run, Nola shouted as Trey took off, scurrying through the overgrown grass, hopping the fence into the neighbor's backyard. "That's my girl," Royal bellowed, spit flying from his lips, his nostrils flaring, throwing one last punch in the air. His face was purple, the web of veins swelling below his eyes. 6 feet away, Nola was still on the ground near the flattened beer can. She was watching Trey run, watching the rage on Royal's face, watching him turn his attention toward her, and cursing herself for being so damn stupid. Thinking she could actually have something good. 95. Fair Winds, Pennsylvania. Today. Camera World. That was the store Charmaine forgot. "Mr. T," she shouted through the phone at Camera World owner John Tang, a tall, handsome Asian man who used to wear his hair in a long ponytail. "You know you can call me John." "John, of course." "Sorry, how are you?" Charmaine asked, suddenly wondering if calling him Mr. T had been racist or just annoying. "Terry Ainsley sends her love, by the way." "She told me," he said, already sounding exhausted. "And also told me what you'd be calling about." Back in the day, or at least in the days of real cameras, Charmaine and Zig had brought their undeveloped film to Camera World. They'd bought their original camcorder there. Most important, Camera World was the place that transferred their old videos, their wedding, to tons of birthday parties, from the camera's videotape to DVD. "You're wondering if I converted any videotapes for superstars. If I might have one of your daughter, Maggie." "If I might have one of Maggie," Mr. Tang continued, his voice now calm, serene. "You know we closed the store years ago." "I know. But I figured if you kept backups, we never made backups. We'd never have the space to store them all. Plus, a client's footage belongs only to the client, so no. I don't have tapes of your daughter. I'm sorry." Curling forward in her seat, elbows on her knees, Charmaine realized that was it. She'd hit the last dead end of all the dead ends. "I appreciate the time," she was about to say. "Of course, if you contacted the client directly..." "What client?" "Superstars," he said. "They were clients for years." "Hold on," Charmaine blurted, popping out of her seat. "You're saying you don't have the footage, but..." "Gloria Cash was the superstar's owner. She'd record her videos, then bring a box of tapes over every Friday so we could transfer them to DVD. But she... I spoke to Gloria's daughter. She said she checked all the videotapes. I'm sure she did. But there's a reason people record over old videotapes. You can reuse them once you convert them to a more stable medium," Mr. Tang explained. "So if I call her back, it might be possible that in addition to videotapes, she might also have some DVDs? I'd certainly say it's worth a call. Don't you think, Mrs. Zagorowski?" 96. The first shot hit Roddy in the stomach. Zig had seen it before, with Afghan snipers targeting American troops. Instead of going for the kill shot, they'd aim for the knees, or more often, the belly, knowing it's usually a non-lethal hit, but also knowing exactly what happens when stomach acid and bile leak into the abdominal cavity. The pain is unbearable. "Roddy, get down!" Zig shouted, though Roddy didn't hear it. He was still in shock, blinking, standing there, staring down at the bloody wound blooming red from his stomach. As the Reds entered the room, the color leaked from Roddy's face. His legs started to buckle, but he was on his feet. Good sign, minimum blood loss, though he didn't realize he was still holding onto the handcuffs, still holding Elijah in place. With his free hand, Roddy reached for his own gun. Across the room, Reagan pulled the trigger again. The bullet burrowed into Roddy's forearm. A jolt of electricity ran to his elbow. Broken ulna, though it was nothing compared to the blazing flame that was now ignited in his stomach. As pain set in, he fought to stay on his feet, holding tight to the handcuffs, pulling Elijah closer like a shield. "Don't shoot! Don't shoot!" Elijah pleaded, trying to duck down, hands still cuffed behind his back. Reagan marched forward, her gun still trained on Roddy. Seabass was in lockstep behind her, the two of them moving as a single unit, weaving methodically through the pallets of push packages. In truth, Seabass's coloring was worse than Roddy's, but adrenaline kicked in quickly, and so did his training. As Reagan went right, Seabass swept left, aiming his gun at Zig and scanning the wider part of the room. The gauze still covered most of his cheek, but his bloody mouthguard looked shiny between his lips, a macabre smile, like he was enjoying himself. "Roddy, I never take pleasure in someone's pain," Reagan warned, "but I have to say,
I'm looking forward to making an exception.
Without warning, Reagan's eyes slid sideways and she aimed her gun at Zig. Seabass aimed his directly at Roddy's face, his finger gripping the trigger. That was their deal. Seabass gets the kill shot.
Don't shoot, don't shoot,
Elijah begged, still ducking down. Roddy pulled Elijah closer, using him as a shield. Next to them, Zig had his hands in the air, trying to process it all. Time skidded to a halt, making it feel like everyone was underwater. Elijah was still in mid-yell as Zig glanced back to the reception area, like he was waiting for someone else to enter. But no one was coming.
Do not shoot! Do not!
Elijah yelled, still bent over, his body contorted.
I can help! I know where the money is!
Seabass stopped, throwing a look at his partner. Reagan's eyes narrowed. What money?